Thanks, Neil. Welcome to Research Presentation 1, the first presentation of Saber 44. I am Rayanne Martinez. I'm room monitor. I will see to your needs and to the needs of our presenter. He is Rob Fitz. He is presenting on The Minions of Mikado, the quest to form the first professional Japanese-American baseball team. I would ask also if you make sure your cell phones are silenced, your conversations are silenced, and if any calls out, if you get, please take them outside so Rob gets our full attention. Thank you, and welcome, Rob Fitz.
It's almost cliche. Immigrant child arrives in America, not speaking the language, dressed in funny clothes, completely out of touch with his new surroundings. He learns about a game local kids play and follow in the newspaper. Baseball becomes his entryway to American culture. He grows up as a hyphenated American, successful and, of course, a baseball fan. Today's story follows a different path. It's a summary of a larger study about a group who arrived in America not as poor immigrants, but as college-educated sons of the middle class, bent on making their fortunes and returning to their homeland. But something got in their way, their love of the game. Some turns and images in this paper are offensive. I use them not out of ignorance or callousness, but to depict the times accurately. On April 7, 1903, 20-year-old Atsuyoshi Shaisho stepped off the gangway of the steamer Gaelic and entered San Francisco. It seemed like a different world. Everything I saw and heard was strange to me and surprising. Most of the 30,000 Japanese who had immigrated to California before him were small farmers, escaping poverty caused by overpopulation and widespread crop failure. Saisho, however, had come for a different reason. His father was mayor of the city of Miyakonjo. His father a samurai. His ancestors renowned warriors. Atsuyoshi had studied English at Waseda University and now was on his way to Stanford to study business. Life in the U.S., however, proved more difficult than Atsuyoshi had anticipated. He found his English too weak to complete Stanford's coursework. Instead of returning to Japan, Saisho decided to remain in California. He soon discovered that most white-collar jobs were closed to Japanese. He adapted, found work in the fields, toiling in an Alaskan salmon cannery, and later washing dishes in a San Franciscan restaurant. After almost 3 years, he moved to Los Angeles, a city known for its tolerance of Japanese immigrants. There, an opportunity arrived that would change his life. Saisho had been the captain and catcher of his high school baseball team. In L.A., he joined the team at Rafu Shimpo, the city's Japanese newspaper, and met 23-year-old Ken Kitsuse. Kitsuse's father was also a politician in Japan, and his brother had attended Waseda University. Nonetheless, after their father remarried, the two brothers set out to California. Ken was a natural athlete, excelling at judo, kendo, and running, as well as being the best Japanese ball player on the West Coast. A teammate remembered, "We considered him the god of baseball. When somebody made a mistake, he would give them hell, or in Japanese, drop thunder. For this reason, we called him Thunder." In March 1906, an Anglo-American named Dan Tobey and a Japanese named Tozen Matsuko approached the ball players with an interesting proposition. They wanted to form a professional Japanese barnstorming team. The previous spring, Waseda University had become the first Japanese ball club to visit the U.S. Led by their swashbuckling shortstop, Shin Hashido, the Waseda Nine played 25 games on the West Coast. American fans filled the ballpark to witness the spectacle. The hype surrounding Waseda's tour gave Guy Green an idea. Green owned the Nebraska Indians baseball team, a semi-pro squad of mostly Native Americans that barnstormed across the country playing local clubs and entertaining fans with a mix of good baseball and carnival-like atmosphere. They camped in an Indian village, sometimes dressed in buckskin with feathered headdresses, and put on pre-game shows. The team was immensely popular, playing over 100 games a season and drawing large crowds. But Green was always looking for ways to expand his business. According to a widely circulated press release, in late 1905, Green hired Tozen Matsuko, quote, a Japanese of baseball fame living in California, to visit the Mikado's kingdom and gather together a squad of ballplayers of reputation to import to this country for the purpose of making a tour of the United States. No documents verify Matsuko's trip to Japan. Instead, he seems to have built his team from Japanese immigrants. Four members of Rashu Shinpo's team, including Saisho and Kitsuse, joined Green's squad and traveled to Havelock, Nebraska to practice. To Saisho's great disappointment, Toby decided that neither he nor Matsuko were talented enough to play on the team. Both men would remain with the group, however, as helpers. Toby also decided to bolster the squad with several non-Japanese. On April 15, Guy Green's Japanese ball club began a five-month barnstorming team of the Midwest, playing roughly 100 games against amateur town and semi-pro teams in eight states. Despite the hostility towards Japanese immigrants in Northern California, much of the country was fascinated by Japan. Japanese style influenced American architecture, design, and entertainment. And the public seemed enthralled by the island nation's surprising victory in the Russo-Japanese War. Guy Green fed on this fascination to promote his club. Newspaper releases emphasized the exotic nature of his players. Green's Japs are the most novel baseball organization the world has ever known. Every player is a genuine full-blood Japanese. Not one of these Japanese can speak a word of English. They do all their conversing and coaching in Japanese, and it is certainly the most Japanesey Japanese you have ever listened to. The chances are not one of our citizens has ever seen a Japanese team play baseball, an opportunity which no one can afford to miss. Keeping with their fascination with the Russo-Japanese War, newspaper writers sprinkled their articles with allusions to the conflict. One paper noted, "We thought our team the strongest, Port Arthur, but it seems like the baseball players of Japan are like the soldiers, swept everything before them." An article about Kitsuse linked him directly to the war. It read, "One of the most interesting members of Green's Japanese baseball team is Kitsuse, who left school in Japan to serve during the late Great War with Russia. He was wounded in the left leg at Mukden so severely that he had to go home and even yet limped slightly. He is one of the best men on the team, however, and always a great favorite with the crowds." Story, however, was a lie, probably designed to give the team a recognizable and colorful star. Kitsuse had arrived in the U.S. in 1902, 2 years before the start of the war. Other pieces, probably planted by Dan Toby, exaggerated the team's skills. "Green's Japs have with them four of the best pitchers of Japan, the champion long-distance thrower of the empire, the greatest Japanese shortstop in the world, bar none, and the pick of all the players from the various schools and universities of Japan." Like the Nebraska Indians, the team entertained fans with more than baseball. Games were often preceded with demonstrations of jiu-jitsu or kendo. Even at 25 cents per ticket, crowds filled the rural ballparks to see the show. Although some reporters praised the Japanese for playing splendidly and excelling in base running and fielding, many agreed that the team did not live up to the hype. Several journalists complained that despite being advertised as the only Japanese team in the United States, the starting nine included five Caucasians who were, quote, far superior than the Japanese. Others were unimpressed with the level of play. One reporter griped, "The much heralded Japs proved a failure as far as their baseball qualifications were concerned. From the very start, it was evident that the visitors from the island empire were clearly outclassed." "The game was one-sided and rather uninteresting," complained the Quincy Daily Whig, "the Japs showing a limited knowledge of the great American sport." the Piccadilly capital was even blunter. Having once watched the Japanese team play baseball, we now have never understood how the Japanese fleet managed to hit the Russian ships. At the end of the barnstorming season in early October, the team folded and Guy Green and his Japanese players parted ways. Saisho and his teammates from the Rafu Shimpo returned to LA and formed the Nanka Japanese Baseball Club. Two more Waseda graduates soon joined the team. Keiichi Suzuki, who had become a pillar of the club, and Shin Hashijo, the university's former captain and future member of the Japan Baseball Hall of Fame. "We were crazy about baseball," Suzuki recalled. "Nothing was more interesting than playing baseball on Sunday and holidays when we were young. We never took jobs that would prevent us from taking Sunday off, no matter how good the opportunity was." Despite their education, Suzuki and Kitsuse worked as gardeners for Anglo families, while Saisho became a janitor at Meyer Siegel department store. Games were usually against unaffiliated white or African-American teams in Highland Park. With open discrimination and even outright violence towards Japanese common in the period, the team was unable to join any of the area's numerous baseball leagues. When they applied for the newly formed Valley League in December 1907, for example, they were not among the accepted teams. In the early days of Japanese baseball, members of the Ichigo High School team segregated themselves from their classmates in a special dormitory to focus on the game, strengthen bonds, and instill the proper samurai values to help them win. Their success on the diamond promoted other schools and the Nanka Club to follow suit. The players moved into a bungalow at 35 South Maple Avenue in downtown LA. An open lot behind the house provided young men a place to practice. There's just one problem. Tracks from the nearby trolley lines ran through the field, disrupting play and adding an element of danger to the games. In early 1909, the club felt ready to barnstorm across the country. Using Tozen Matsuko as their reporter, they arranged games in California and Colorado. Now calling themselves a professional club, Matsuko filled the Riverside and Denver papers with the usual hyperbole to promote the team. Tozen Matsuko's stars, the Riverdale Press was told, is composed of the best players of the Flowery Kingdom, coming straight from the Orient, who are not easily defeated. The Japanese team, however, failed to live up to its billing. The tour began with a 9-3 loss to the African-American LA Giants, an embarrassing 15-9 defeat by LA High School, and a 17-0 pummeling by the local Riverside Nine. The Japanese team was made to realize that the American national game is not their game, concluded the Riverside Daily Press. Following the games, the local Japanese residents threw a party to cheer up their defeated countrymen. Asked to give a speech, Hashido supposedly replied, "A defeated general has no words," and quit the team. The following day, the remaining team members were robbed. Defeated on the diamond and in spirit, Saisho, Kitsuse, and their teammates canceled the proposed tour and returned home. Intelligent and by now nearly bilingual, Saisho had advanced from Meyer Seeger's janitor to a sales clerk and then a floor supervisor. He saved his wages and invested in real estate in the San Fernando Valley. In a few years, he became financially comfortable, but as he would later explain, "My passion for baseball completely obsessed me. I quit my job to devote all my time to my favorite sport." In 1911, we planned a tour to the East. Calling themselves the Japan Baseball Association, or JBBA, the team barnstormed across seven states in 25 weeks, playing about 140 games. Whether by coincidence or design, both Waseda and Keio universities were also touring the United States at the same time, undercutting the novelty of a Japanese baseball squad. To differentiate themselves, the JBBA claimed to be the, quote, only Japanese professional baseball team in the United States, stronger than the university teams that are presently visiting the country. "It is reported they are the fastest folks on bases yet," said the Albuquerque Morning Journal. The whole team showing up in Ty Cobb's class. Yet, the tour got off to a sour start when the true identities of three players were discovered during the first game. Lockhart, the young Indian heaver, is Fushima, reported the LA Times. Padilla played second base and answered the name of Yama. The other played third and is registered in the scorebook as Naza. These names have a Nipponese accent, but their owners appeared strangely bewildered when the manager forgot and gave them some instructions in Japanese. Even with their secret revealed, the team relied on these men and other non-Japanese ringers throughout the tour. A surviving ledger book allows us to track the team's journey across Middle America. Although Saisho put up the capital for the endeavor from his own savings, the account book shows that the team planned to be self-sustaining and hopefully turn a profit. It begins with a zero balance and details every expenditure, including stops for ice cream, as well as the gate receipts for each game. The ledger shows how difficult it was for a barnstorming team to turn a profit. Gate receipts vary from a high of $125 received in the city of Trinidad, Colorado, to a low of just $3.30 from the mining town of Ripley, Iowa, population 407, with most games bringing in between $20 and $30. But expenses usually ran just below gate receipts, leaving the team particularly vulnerable to bad luck. 2 days of rain, for example, canceled games on July 28th and 29th in Iowa. With no income but room and board to pay, the team's savings dropped from $64 to just $14. The team recovered, and throughout August and September, the account balance hovered near $100, even reaching a high of $202 on August 24th. Feeling flush, they used $2.75 to create the first known baseball card of a Japanese-American team. Found in a scrapbook from Centerville, Iowa, one side depicts the JBBA team, the other reverse, while the reverse provided two women with admission to the game. Unlike barnstorming African-American teams, the Japanese were welcome in small-town hotels and restaurants. Other than derogatory newspaper references to the players as Japs or little brown men, I found no evidence of anti-Japanese incidents during the tour. One paper noted, "The Japanese team were gentlemanly lot of fellows, and never kicked, and were smiling all the time." Observers noted that the JBA players moved with cat-like rapidity on the diamond and worked together well, fast on their feet, and they played as hard as they can from the time the first ball was put into play until the last man is out. But they were often outclassed by the stronger town nines. A rainy autumn left the team with a balance of just 2 cents on September 30th. "I had a discussion with the players," Saisho recalled, "and we decided to break up. Most of us borrowed money from acquaintances and went back to L.A. I returned flat broke. I was unable to meet the land payments, and my investment in the San Fernando Valley was lost." Their old jobs unavailable, the players worked as farm laborers for the next year before dispersing. Kitsuse and Suzuki headed to Seattle and joined the Asahi Club for the 1914 tour of Japan. They would continue playing until their 50s. Saisho retired as an active player and focused on farming. He got married, raised a family, and rebuilt his savings. In 1920, he sponsored a team of Sherman Indians to tour Japan. But the team lost every game, and Saisho once again lost his savings. 1942, all three men were forced to leave their homes with only a single suitcase to carry their possessions and were incarcerated in the internment camps. After the war, they would reestablish their lives, raise their families, send their kids to college, and become American citizens. Saisho rarely spoke about his early years as a ball player. His son Taro recalls, My father really didn't talk much about baseball. Life was hard, and my mother had trouble making ends meet. He may have been a little bit embarrassed that it wasn't a success." 2 years before his death, Kitsuse wrote, I am not good at anything else but baseball. People claim that I am crazy about it. I think if I had invested the money on property or thought about the future, I could have been a great capitalist. However, I was happy to spend all my money on my beloved baseball. Nothing can cure stupidity. I loved baseball so much. So why focus on Saisho and Kitsuse, two obscure semi-pro ball players? It's often said that the victors write history, and I think that's true in baseball. We focus on the greats. But perhaps we can learn more from the forgotten men who toiled at the game they loved. Using the techniques of microhistory, which is the close study of an event to reveal widespread cultural patterns, we can learn about baseball's role in race relations, assimilation, and how the national game touched all aspects of our society. Thanks. Are there any questions? Of course. He asked what their record was in 1911. Right now, I don't. I've been collecting newspapers and box scores wherever I can find them. I have only 10, and they lost about half of those 10 games. I'm guessing the players are very modest, and when they were interviewed in the 1950s, they said, oh, we lost all the games. But I'm betting that that's not really that far from the truth.
Any other questions?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Rob.